For the week of August 3rd, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 244, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, you're out visiting family. You know, Michael, I almost said, instead of introducing myself, I almost said, I am Groot.
How exciting. Yes, Guardians of the Galaxy is the big story. It's not a big show. We're going to be lean and mean this week, aren't we?
Yeah, well, it's either feast or famine. So last week, of course, we had 2 weeks to catch up on, and we just, it seemed like a 9-hour show. This week, absolutely nothing happened. Summer kicked into full gear this week, and nobody did anything that we could report on. At all.
And yet, we're going to talk about stuff such as...
Well, on this week's show, we'll be telling you about some of the pitfalls the movie industry faces in their conversion to digital technology. We'll also take a quick look at what Aereo has been up to since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the service was a cable operator. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And Michael, you said this week there is a lot to talk about.
That's right. And not just Guardians of the Galaxy. That, of course, is the number one movie around the world. We got our info from Rentrack. We link to their site in our show notes. We also get info from Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, anywhere we can spot some information about the worldwide box office. And the number one movie all over the world is Guardians of the Galaxy, the Marvel roll of the dice that expands their universe even farther. It grossed $160 million worldwide, a big, big debut in North America, blasting past all expectations. We got a lot to talk about it, but we'll catch that at the end of the box office round. Let's get to the other movies first. What do you say?
Okay.
All right. So number two around the world is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Another $56 million. That's going to hit $500 million worldwide. It's passing the reboot starring James Franco, both domestically and worldwide. So it's doing great. At number three, a big hit in China. This is The White-Haired Witch of Lunar Kingdom. I bet we're the only people in North America to say The White-Haired Witch of Lunar Kingdom. It's a Chinese wuxia martial arts fantasy film. I hope I'm pronouncing wuxia properly. I tried to look it up online. They're like, well, it could be wuxia, it could be wuxia. You could pronounce it in Cantonese. And oh my God, I don't know how to say it. But it's a Chinese martial arts film, fantastical elements. Wuxia means essentially martial arts hero, often
okay.
Swordsman hero. So you're just a man of good deeds. And it was a $16 million movie. It grossed $40 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on a Thursday. It's got $44 million in total. It's in six markets. It's based on a novel from the 50s by the great Liang Yusheng, who sort of brought the wuxia genre into its prominence for modern audiences. You know, he was really the guy who just created a whole trend of these types of novels. So that's a big, big hit in Japan. It cost $16 million to make. It's practically tripled it on its opening weekend.
You know why he wrote all those novels? Because he was trying to go international and he knew that, you know, martial arts novels would translate well.
Are you being funny?
Well, apparently not.
Okay. He did retire in Australia and received an honorary degree there and from other people. So he was a big, you know, international figure. At number four around the world, another international film. This is from South Korea. It's called Roaring Currents. It opened to $30 million in South Korea alone, $35 million total. Again, I guess it opened with some previews the day before, something like that. This is a period piece. It's based on an epic national legend, a naval battle, historical naval battle in the 1500s. A famous war hero in South Korea had 12 ships, and he faced off against an invading Japanese armada of 330 ships, and he defeated them. And it's a famous battle, and so this film was made. It was directed by, where is it? Oh, here it is. It was directed by Kim Han-min, and it stars Choi Min-sik, who people here will know from Old Boy, the original version of Old Boy.
Okay.
And he's also in the new Luc Besson film, Lucy. He plays a bad guy in that film. He sort of dopes up poor old Scarlett Johansson with a lot of drugs. And he's a very outspoken actor politically. He's tussled with the South Korean government. He doesn't like some of what Hollywood does. He retired from acting for a while, but he's come back. And now he's in this big, big hit. So that sounds like a really fun film to look out for.
So he is South Korea's Shia LaBeouf.
No, not at all, Shia LaBeouf. No.
Didn't Shia LaBeouf retire from acting for all of 5 minutes?
This is an acclaimed actor in good movies who's politically prominent, not a guy who's doing art stunts.
Oh, okay.
By the way, we'll get to Shia LaBeouf in a minute. At number five is Hercules, the Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Can we still say The Rock?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, why not? $25 million. It's at $100 million worldwide. It needs to triple that in order to be in good shape. But, you know, it's got a ways to go. Certainly, Guardians of the Galaxy did not help this film in North America.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And number six, again, our hero from Roaring Currents is also in Lucy. That made another $23 million. It's at $84 million total. It's mostly just opened in North America. So almost all of that is from this country. So it's got a long ways to go. Luc Besson is a big name brand around the world. That's sure to do much better before all is said and done. That certainly was the case for Transformers. It's now past $1 billion, the first film of the year to do so. And, you know, it still has not caught up with the last Transformers film. That grossed $1.1 billion. I think this will match that and probably exceed it a little bit. But, you know, everybody talked about, oh, they needed to dump Shia. Oh, they got to get rid of Shia. It's like, well, you know what? Every Transformers film made more money than the one before. And the last one made $1.1 billion. So I don't see why there was impression that, oh, he was holding the franchise back. I never understood that attitude.
Well, I don't know either, but I would be curious to know whether...
They're glad they did it now, I imagine.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I hope he's somewhere drinking chamomile tea, talking to his friends, and getting his act together.
I wonder if the increased amount that Transformers made with each successive film not only outpaced inflation, which I would imagine it did, but also the number of territories it opened in. I wonder how many more territories...
Didn't they all... I'm sure they all opened worldwide, didn't they?
Well, you know, I don't think the first Transformers opened in China. Maybe it did. I don't know.
Well, China's a special issue, but every other country, wouldn't you think? I mean, that's a worldwide property, wasn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really, there is no record of like worldwide box office. We never know what countries films are still waiting to open up in, things like that. Like How to Train Your Dragon is at number eight. How to Train Your Dragon 2, another $21 million. It's at $465 million worldwide. It's still going to open in China. That hasn't come yet, I believe. It's still waiting to open in China. So that could be a good boost to the box office. It's about to match the first one. So that's good news. But it has been a little draggy, and you would have hoped it would have expanded on the original and taken it to another level. That hasn't happened. The first one made $500 million worldwide. But it also, in North America alone, made $160 million on DVD and Blu-ray sales. That doesn't even count streaming and
wait, cable
sales.
This is How to Train Your Dragon 2?
The original made another $160 million in home video sales alone. So that's a big number that they're looking forward to. When you talk about how profitable these films are, you know, that's a big number to keep in mind. And so that's why there is a How to Train Your Dragon 3 scheduled for 2016.
Although DreamWorks Animation, I guess,
reported... They're having a bad time.
Yeah, they reported a $15 million loss this past quarter. So, and they...
Did we get to them? They had the SEC investigating them for their write-down that they claimed on Turbo, a movie we talked a lot about. They had what you just reported. They had something else bad go on. They just had a horrible, horrible week.
Yeah, I did not know about the SEC investigation.
It was about the write-down on Turbo. I'm not sure what the issues are. They're like, oh, it's a normal, typical investigation.
Right.
You know, things get looked into every once in a while. We don't know if there's anything improper going on, but they are investigating, so they had to announce that or wanted to announce that. So that was happening. They had the lower quarter than expected. How to Train Your Dragon 2 got great reviews, and we would have hoped it would have bumped up another level. It didn't do that. So it has not been a great time for DreamWorks Animation.
Absolutely not.
It is a great time for Han Han. That's the Chinese blogger, political. I don't know that he's political. I keep forgetting to look that up. He's a blogger. He's a motorcycle racer, a race car driver. He's just a superhero. He is, what's his name, Jim Stark from Iron Man, come to life without the mechanical armor. And his film, his directorial debut, Continent, made another $17 million. It's at $82 million worldwide. And number 10 is Get On Up, the James Brown biopic. It cost $30 million to make. It opened in North America alone to $14 million, a solid start for a movie that will appeal to older audiences. We'll have to see if it has legs.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the movie got what I would consider mixed reviews.
Polite
reviews.
People like Chadwick Boseman. The film, not so much.
Right. I guess it takes some liberties with the way it's structured. And not necessarily with the truth or the actual story, but in the timeline. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see if over time more people go see this film, specifically a demographic that is older, as you mentioned, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll jump down to number 12. There's a film that opened up, Girlfriends. It made $13 million. It's in three territories. Based on the distributor, I think it's a Chinese film. I'm not certain. But the title is so generic, I could not find it on the web. There's so many movies called Girlfriend and Girlfriends with one word and two. I found like 50 movies, but I could not find out a movie that opened up this year, right now, somewhere in the world. I have no idea what movie this is.
So it wasn't...
If anybody knows, Send us an email, call us, let us know. How would they do that?
Well, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Can you believe I just had that at my fingertips, by the way?
You've said it so many times, I'm not surprised.
Yes. Exactly about 245, by the way.
Exactly. And with repeats, probably a little bit more.
True.
And you can check out our full list of movies. We've got 20 movies from around the world, all the way down to Dragon Nest Warrior Dawn, which is a Chinese-American co-production, an animated film based on the video game. But the one other movie I like to talk about is at number 15. It's a Japanese film. It's Rurouni Kenshin, The Great Kyoto Fire. This is a sequel to Rurouni Kenshin, which is a Japanese film. It's a live action, but it is based on a beloved manga, which has sold like 50 million copies, and it was turned into a classic anime TV series. So it's a really big franchise. They finally turned it into a feature film. That was a big success, and now they've done a two-part sequel. This one, The Great Kyoto Fire, opens right now. It made $8 million. Not a ton, but a good start. We'll have to see where it ends up. And part two, it's like literally a cliffhanger story. That opens up in like 6 weeks. So unlike The Hobbit, you don't have to wait a year to find out what's going on. They'll tell you right away. I don't know if they've ever seen a cliffhanger open up that quick. As I've said before, there was once a plan to make a film adaptation of the Foundation trilogy, the classic sci-fi novels by Isaac Asimov. At the time, there were three books in this series, and there was a plan. They announced it in Variety, the Foundation summer. They were going to make these live-action movies, and they were going to release them in the summer, like 2 years ahead, and it was going to be one in May, one in June, and one in July. You know, it was 1, 2, 3, because it was one long story. They couldn't imagine anyone would wait a year to see part two. And that was the big plan, and it never happened.
Well, didn't Lord of the Rings kind of break the mold on that,
that was very bold. I mean, I don't think there's anything else like that, is there, before that happened?
Where they made three films at one time with plans to distribute them. Originally, they were going to distribute it at Christmas, then the following summer, then the following Christmas, all within a year.
I still think they should have done it that way, but the post-production was so long, perhaps it was best. They didn't want to be rushed. But yeah, the closest I can think of is The Three Musketeers, where they shot The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers at the same time. But those weren't cliffhanger films where you were waiting for the rest of the story. You know, this was literally one long story. So if the, you know, it was really...
Maybe The Matrix, the last two Matrix films?
Yeah, yeah. I guess they shot both of those at the same time too. But that was before, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, and that didn't turn out well.
No, it did not turn out well, and I don't mean for the characters. I mean for us, the audience, who had to sit through them.
That's right. So then those are the films at the box office. You can check out the full list, but the number one film around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy. It was a big roll of the dice for Marvel, of course, and for Disney. It paid off tremendously well. It got great reviews, far better reviews than I would expect.
I mean, I agree. I mean, 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that is the be-all, end-all of...
But it's a good, I guess, rough estimate. But they include a lot of junk. But even if you look at the main reviews, they were all polite, at the least.
Well, I think partly it's because somebody took a comic book property and took the movie and actually did something a little different and had a little bit of fun with it and kind of made a... I don't even want to say it's a comedy, but they...
It is a comedy.
It's like irreverent.
Firefly. If you like Guardians of the Galaxy, rent the Joss Whedon TV series Firefly. It's a really terrific... It's like a cowboy western in space. Great cast starring Nathan Fillion. Terrific show. There's like 11 episodes or 19 episodes. It has a nice feeling of a beginning, middle, and end, even though it was not intentional. Very much the same larky spirit. Check that out. Great show. Maybe... Good God, why not? Guardians of the Galaxy will help them make another Firefly movie because they did make Serenity, feature film. It did not do great, but it was okay. But oh my gosh, it's very much in the same vein. Larky fun. And this movie opened on 4,080 screens in North America. 75% of them, according to Variety, were 3D. And that includes 3D IMAX, 3D premium large format, D-Box, whatever the heck that is.
Oh my gosh, how could you not know what D-Box is? It's the 4D format where your chair moves around.
No. There were only two 4D screens.
Okay, well, that's because somebody actually named their product 4D. But it is...
Oh, D-Box is the same. There are 127 4D screens in North America?
Well, 127. I guess they call that motion
seats. There are 127 theaters in America equipped to, like, make fog... in your theater and shake your chair?
No. Just D-Box. There's like 127 D-Box screens.
Right, and those shake your chair.
There's no fog and smell-o-vision and
oh, they don't do that stuff? What is that, 5D?
That's 4DX and X4D. And
so what does 4D do other than shake your chair?
I was just kidding around about 4D.
Oh, well, there is 4D. There are two 4D screens, and that's the whole special effect thing. What they put the fog in the room, they shake your chair, they do whatever, you move around like it's a ride, you know, not dramatically so, but, you know, they do all that cued to the movie.
Right.
So there are two screens in North America for that. Who are the fools who paid $25 or $30 for that, I wonder?
Well, you know, D-Box is actually thrown into those quote-unquote 4D screens because it is immersive.
They broke it out. They said 125 D-Box and two 4D screens.
There's a difference between them. It's good for D-Box. It helps market them.
Right. All right. Well, okay. So anyway. Well,
if you care about that kind of.
Were 75% of the screens were 3D in one form or another. 900 screens were in 2D. Right? So you're looking at 25% of the screens were 2D. Guess what? That gave you 55% of your gross. Because 3D contributed about 45% of the box office gross, a little bit better than normal. The new normal, I should say, for 3D, which has been hovering around 40%. So it bumped up to 45% because, I mean, there were so many screens. 75% of the screenings were in 3D, so people had fewer choices. But guess what? Most people wanted to see it in 2D. And in fact, if you look at 900 screens grossing $75 million, that's a rough breakdown, that's about $60,000 per screen.
You know, I'd be
And if you look at 3D, they grossed about $10,000 per screen. Guess what? You should not have so many screens devoted to 3D.
Well, Michael, as you know, we talked about this yesterday in prepping for this show. I'm always curious to know how they're counting those screens, because most 3D screens these days, if they're not dedicated 3D, which few are, they're showing both 3D and 2D, but there are fewer 2D showings for the most part, as we discovered yesterday.
Well, I don't understand this, because I look at my movie theater logo and they've got screen one, 3D, and they list showtimes. And they've got screen three, 2D, and they list showtimes. And it doesn't look like screen three has a 2D showing at noon and a 3D showing at three. That would seem to be very annoying and difficult for them. I wouldn't think they'd do that, because you got to flip the lenses back and forth.
Oh,
you think
they actually do that? They absolutely don't. In fact, in my sixplex,
really?
I was watching the opening of the film and I thought, wow, this movie is really dark. I said, wait a second. Is it really dark or is it? And I turned around. Sure enough, there were two beams coming out of the projection booth. And I went, no, it's a Sony projector, or it's a projector in which they did not take the 3D lens off.
Oh. So they were showing it 2D earlier that day?
I was watching it in 2D myself. They were showing it in 3D earlier that
day. Why would they jump back and forth like that in one screen location? What's the advantage of that?
Because then you're offering the product. I know people hate it when I call a movie a product.
Call it a movie.
They're offering the movie in both formats.
I know they are, but why would they go back and forth? And why wouldn't screen four just be 2D?
Because
why would they bother going back and forth?
Because you're either offering six different movies in a sixplex, or you're offering five different movies in a sixplex, and they prefer to offer six different movies in, you know, every screen dedicated to another movie. Although in this case,
they never did.
It depends on the complex.
I go to AMC 25, half the screens are Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, and that is a special case. I was going to say it depends on the complex.
It happens every week, an opening weekend for every big movie.
You
there
get
like
these
three,
megaplex.
Four, five, six, eight, 10 screens.
Yeah, you get a megaplex, an Orange at the block at Orange, I think has 30 screens. Then yes, you have a lot of screens dedicated to one film. But when you have a sixplex, what they're trying to do is get as many films into that theater as possible. When you have 10 or more screens is when you can usually start seeing the doubling up of
Well, there aren't many
title.
Sixplexes left, are there?
I don't know about that.
They don't build any sixplexes anymore.
I would find it hard to believe. I think those are special circumstances when they're building, I think, more like seven and up.
Even seven? That seems small.
Well, it depends on the property. It depends on the real estate.
Well, the fact is, Guardians of the Galaxy made a ton more on 2D than 3D. 55% versus 45%. A 60,000 per screen average for those 900 screens. I bet they would have made more money on 2D if there were more screenings available.
Well, that's probably true.
Yeah, but clearly this is a game changer. This was a big roll of the dice. I mean, as people said, Iron Man was a big roll of the dice. People didn't know Iron Man. He wasn't that well known outside of comic book geek people. I barely knew Iron Man, and I'm pretty familiar with comic books. Obviously not that familiar, but you know what I mean. You know, I'm conversant in comic books. I didn't really know Iron Man. I'd heard of him, but that was it.
You say that like, you know, yeah, Joe, I kind of know Joe, but I've never been personally introduced.
Well, so that was a big roll of the dice when they launched the whole world with the Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man. But guess what? It was a good movie. I mean, relatively speaking, he gave a really good performance. He was really charming. It was a breakout hit. And they keep thinking, oh, it's this universe building. It's all this trick of linking the films and having the kicker. And you gotta have one release part. No, they've made like 9 movies in a row that have gotten good reviews and fans have loved them. It's just like Pixar. If you make movies that people really love, you're going to have success. It's not that they're all interconnected. Pixar movies weren't interconnected, except that they were all good.
Although you just confused Iron Man for Guardians of the Galaxy. So are you making their point or are you when you do that? Or are you just kind of it was a Freudian slip, as they say?
I don't think it's a Freudian slip.
OK.
I don't subconsciously wish Guardians of the Galaxy were Iron Man.
OK. You're not reaching back into your psychological past at all.
No. So, I mean, you look at what's happened after the Avengers. Iron Man 3 basically doubled the grosses of Iron Man and Iron Man 2 individually. Captain America practically doubled the first Captain America. Thor did almost 50% better than the first Thor. And now we have Guardians of the Galaxy with a massive opening weekend. We'll have to see where it ends up. But audiences are loving it. Everybody I knew who saw it in 2D.
Yes.
They really did. The doorman, the guy at my mailbox, my friend with his wife and 2 kids, they all saw it in 2D, I always ask, and they all loved it. They all had a great time.
Well, it's got great characters. I don't know if we pointed out that it made $94 million here in North America, which is the highest August opening ever.
Right.
We had some conversation before we started recording about whether Marvel was a franchise. And I said, no, it's not a franchise. Harry Potter is a franchise, but instead it is a brand. And you slap that brand onto things and it kind of gives it a certain cachet.
Like the Disney name means safe family entertainment for a long time. And that was a valuable brand. So Variety said the Marvel franchise is at $6.3 billion. This is before Guardians opened. And they're saying it's second only to the Harry Potter franchise in all of movie history.
Well, what I would say is the Marvel franchises, because it has more than one franchise.
Right, exactly. So now the Harry Potter, when that other movie, the magical creatures guy, when that trilogy opens, that won't be part of the Harry Potter franchise. It's in the same world, but it's a different series of films. Like, they're comparing all of Marvel's movies to like James Bond or the 6 Star Wars films with the same characters, one long same story. It's the Harry Potter movie. Those are franchises. You know, a series of movies with the same characters telling one long story or individual adventures with the same hero like Indiana Jones. That is a franchise. Marvel, with like all these different movies with all these different characters, this is a brand.
Well, what I want to know is
the characters overlap. But like if Marvel is a franchise, then so is Pixar.
Yes, correct. And Pixar is a brand, not a franchise.
And now, shockingly, that $6.3 billion does not include grosses for Spidey or Fantastic Four or the X-Men. So if you do call it a franchise, it's really like a $10 billion franchise.
What I want to know is, when do you refer to the world of a film versus the universe? I mean, with Harry Potter, is it the world of Harry Potter? And with Marvel, is it the universe?
When they leave?
Yeah.
Well, we're in the same galaxy, I guess. So maybe we should say the galaxy of Marvel. But, they left Earth.
Yes, that's true.
Thor did too. Well, even Thor Part 2, I think, was briefly on Earth. So, you know, they were, and they had a moment on Earth in Guardians of the Galaxy. But essentially, it's a space opera.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a space opera and it's a hardcore comic book movie. I'm kind of astonished people who don't read comic books know what the heck is going on.
Well, I took my kids to see it and I still think they had no clue what was going on.
They didn't care. They were happy.
They liked the tree, you know, Groot, played by Vin Diesel, who actually, I guess, did his own dubbing in like 6 or 7 different languages, because let's face it, when you have one line, that's not so difficult. but he also, they also liked the raccoon, although don't call him a raccoon.
No.
Yeah.
So Disney paid $4 billion for Marvel. Good investment. They paid, you know, and of course, now we're going to see more and more Marvel characters come into the Disney theme parks.
Oh, you think?
And
they're
going to be rides. Well, now, but that's huge because they're going to be able to bring more kids, more boys, more young men, more teenagers to their parks, you know, far more than they ever did with singing princesses.
Well, you know, what I think is going to be interesting is when they put, Lucasfilm, right? They now own Lucasfilm. They paid $4 billion for it.
Same price.
Although, actually, Star Wars and DC are not both owned by Disney. So this this makes no sense. I shouldn't have started this line of thinking.
No, it was just a goofy crossover.
Right, that Zack Snyder, I guess, jealous that some other comic book movie was making headlines.
No, he was having fun.
He took a picture of Batman with R2-D2 and posted it to Twitter.
And he called it Batman and Robin, R2-B-I-N, you know?
Yeah.
It was very, very cute. And there's another picture with Batman wearing a Jedi, you know...
Cape.
Cape or whatever that's called, shawl, cowl, whatever it might be. So yeah, so that's kind of interesting. That's a fun, amusing little crossover. And you know, we don't always get figures for Latin America, but there's sort of an interesting factoid about Argentina. Turns out Hollywood's been making money in Argentina for 2 years, but because of the currency crisis in that country, they've left it in Argentina. There's tens of millions of dollars sitting in Argentinian banks waiting for their currency crisis to end so Hollywood can take out their money and not lose a ton of its value by where the Argentinian currency is in the world market.
Yeah, this is a long-standing issue with Argentina.
Right, their money is stranded in that country. Their box office, they're making money. They're still releasing in Argentina because that country is considered a tastemaker country. Who knew that Argentina was considered a tastemaker for Central and South America? If it does well in Argentina, other countries will follow suit. And now
yes.
I've just angered all the other Latin American countries.
A couple points here. One, you know what? The studios don't make that much money from Argentina. So much so that they, when it came to converting Argentina to digital, it was very difficult because the question was, especially when negotiating...
Who the heck is going to pay for it?
Right. Negotiating virtual print fee deals, they wanted to do it in dollars, not in not in whatever currency, the local currency, because then they put themselves at risk for a fluctuating, all of a sudden something that costs 10 U.S. dollars.
Do they do that in every country?
It depends on the country and the history of the currency in that country. So in Argentina, they were like, no, we're doing U.S. dollars. We can't get any of the pesos. I think it's the Argentinian
peso.
Yeah, we can't get any money out of Argentina. So what they're doing is they have companies, Argentinian companies in those countries or, divisions in those countries that are their own separate entities that they leave the money there to operate those companies. But they did not care enough to convert those cinemas because they weren't making enough money. They basically said, you know what? Argentina, huge headache. They need to get their act together. When they get their act together, come and see us. We're not going to spend all this time.
So that's why there's still celluloid in certain Central and South American countries?
Well, specifically in Argentina.
Is that the only one?
I think, well, maybe Venezuela. Venezuela, actually, I think most of it is converted. I would imagine maybe Peru. It's slowly being converted. It is the last territory, South America and Latin America, to undergo full conversion. Argentina will probably, ironically, go last, even though it's a tastemaker country. And that's because of not only the currency issue, but also all the laws and the political situation in that country.
Yeah. Well, they have defaulted on their currency twice in the last 13 years, so it's far from cleared up yet. I mean, that just happened. The last time was just just a short time ago. So, it's been going on for a while.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You would think if they converted to digital, everything would be easier. Easier to keep track of what movies you're showing, easier to keep track of everything. There'd be no problems with digital projection once you get to switch over and not have to lug prints around and figure out what is what. Everything's coded and tagged. Everything works like a dream. Isn't that true? Just like in Virginia.
Yeah, absolutely. Digital is so much better. Yeah.
So an audience in Virginia went to a Regal Cinemas to watch Guardians of the Galaxy, and they sat down and they watched 15 minutes of trailers, and then they started to watch the animated film Rise of the Guardians.
Hey, first of all, you know what? They got the Guardians part right, okay? So to their credit, they got the Guardians part right.
Right. So because the name said Guardians, they somehow pulled out the wrong digital film, which I don't know why they still had a copy of Rise of the Guardians in place, but they did. And they showed it and they came out, oh, we'll fix it. Well, sorry about that. They went back. They watched the same 15 minutes of previews again. And then they started to show Rise of the Guardians again.
Okay. Well, secondly, okay. So I credit them for getting the Guardians part right. Secondly, in the world are they only showing 15 minutes of trailers? Nowadays, I sit through like half an hour of trailers, maybe 45 minutes of trailers. Okay, the 45 minutes part is exaggerating. So I guess is the half hour. It's more like 20, 22 minutes of trailers.
So I have two questions for you. One, why do they still have a copy of Rise of the Guardians in their digital file?
Well, okay. When you go to the movie theater now, more than likely you're seeing a digital print. And what that means is there is a server that is holding all of the electronic files that make up a movie and a projector in the projection booth.
Right, but it's a 212 film. Why wasn't it erased from the database? Wouldn't the studio demand that?
Well, they don't demand that, actually. Often, these films are on kind of like an auto-delete, and the older they get without being played, they just kind of get automatically deleted. But it depends on the technology. It depends on the server that is being used and the server manufacturer and what the features and functionality of that server are. But also, they tend to keep films around that they plan on showing in the future. Rise of the Guardians is probably one of those films that will be shown at Christmas time, since it's more of a holiday movie.
It's got Santa and Jack Frost and the Easter Bunny all in play in that film, right?
Right. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was shown this summer at one of those like early kid matinees.
Like at the 11 a.m. So they planned and said, oh, let's keep a copy of this on hold because we're probably going to want to show it again.
Right. Now, they can't show it necessarily whenever they want because there has to be a key to unlock that movie for a given time frame.
Right. So they've got the file on hand and they just ask for the key so they can show it again and everything's cool. So how come they got the movies mixed up?
Well, and this is, you know, I can't wait for the next standards and recommendations meetings, because this will probably be a never-ending topic. And it is a never-ending topic every single month when we meet. And I guarantee you at one of the next meetings, this thing will
meetings
be...
Meetings of what?
Meetings of basically technologists and different manufacturers in the digital cinema community coming together and discussing the industry's pain and advances.
You're part of the standards committee?
Yeah, like SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers. They write standards for these types of things. You know what they haven't written a standard for?
What?
How to identify a motion picture.
So you mean they literally just type in whatever, like Guardians of the Galaxy or Guardians?
Yes, and actually, I think it's digitalcinemanamingconvention.com. You can go and see the naming convention. Anybody can go to that website and see the naming convention for how you label each file on a hard drive or in a satellite feed to a theater that gets downloaded either onto a server or onto what's called a theater management system, which is kind of a central server for all the different screens in a complex.
But movies have the same names all the time.
Oh,
Why don't they just give them a unique code, like a unique number? Why don't they have like a consortium and give everybody, every movie, a unique code, and there'll never be any confusion?
The gentleman from Los Angeles would like to yield his time to the gentleman from Birmingham.
What do you mean? I don't get it.
Meaning I've been saying, a lot of people have been saying this and screaming at the top of their lungs for years, saying, get your act together. You're going to have to be able to automatically, through an automated system, no humans involved, be able to have a machine look at a file and know what version it is, what the content it is.
Yeah, 2D, 3D, da-da-da. I mean, you know, it's 3D all, IMAX, you want different code for each of them. Well, who objects?
Well, there's different reasons why that hasn't occurred. The first is...
And they're all stupid.
Well, the first is
they're all stupid reasons.
Well, yeah, nobody wants to centralize the identification of a piece of content, because then there might be a quote-unquote gatekeeper within the industry.
If everybody creates an anonymous little thing to handle this, I mean, it's just, you know, it's not a gatekeeper. Then what, are they going to suddenly charge $10,000 to give you a code? No, it's a nonprofit thing created by the industry to provide a generic code.
Well, that's one of the issues. Okay, so as you say, the fear of like, gee, if we create this entity...
But they'll control it.
Right, but then there's an antitrust issue and whose number is being used.
Sakes.
And by the way, it's a room full of technology engineers. Don't you think they all have an opinion on how the ID number or identifier should... Yeah, that's a whole conversation in and of itself. Which identifier to use, whether it's an intelligent identifier that you can look at as a human and read it and go, oh, well, that's a Warner Brothers film. I know that because the numbers 1, 2, and 3 are in it. Uh-huh. There's that issue. The other issue is that putting metadata onto a file within a file might actually break some of the servers and equipment that is in the field today. So that's another reason. The other issue is that some of the equipment can't actually show the file name, the complete file name. So there are all these reasons that these legacy reasons that we started with, let's say, standard def, and we all want to move to high def, where all of this fancy digital cinema technology could be used. And unfortunately, we can't, because everybody now has standard def televisions. That may be a bad analogy, but effectively, the technology in the field needs to be updated
That is ridiculous.
More. Yeah.
Well, that's giving me a headache. Let's move on to something far less complicated, television and the Aereo debate with the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, that's way less complicated, because really what we're talking about here is Aereo was told by the U.S. Supreme Court.
What was Aereo?
Oh,
what is Aereo?
Aereo is a company.
And will be.
And will be a company where you can rent an antenna, basically, and watch broadcast stations, free over-the-air stations. They all have to be broadcast, no cable networks.
With a DVR-like device.
With a DVR-like device, i.e. your computer in this case. They stream it to your computer.
So if you're getting Hulu and Netflix and you just want to be able to get your basic TV network channels, you could have conceivably paid a small, modest monthly fee to Aereo and cut the cord on your cable company, and there goes your $150 bill.
Right.
So that was the company, and they went all the way to the Supreme Court because the cable companies and the TV networks...
It was the broadcast networks that went, CBS, Fox, NBC, and ABC. They went after them and said, hey, you know what? We are charging people for that. We charge Time Warner Cable.
Well, the cable companies hated them too, surely.
Yeah, well, not as much, because they're not free over the air, and the cable companies couldn't really...
They didn't weigh in and do a front of the court briefs and
not
say...
Not as much.
Really?
Not as much.
So the broadcast networks took them to court, fought them. They went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said...
You're a cable company. Not because you are a cable company, but you kind of look like a cable company, so we're going to say that you're a cable company because you look like a duck, so you must be a duck. We're not going to actually look at the technology. We're going to acknowledge the fact that you basically have a little clever technology loophole that you're, you know, getting around the laws,
regulations,
but we're going to slap you down and say that you're a cable company.
And who was our guest who talked about Aereo and that Supreme Court ruling?
Denise Howell.
And you and Denise both convinced me that I was sort of wrong in my initial impression that no, that this was a bad ruling by the Supreme Court, that it's not a cable company, it's a loophole, and they exploited it, and that's what happens till you change the loophole. And so you convinced me it wasn't a cable company, but then Aereo turned around and said, fine, if we're a cable company, then we get to pay a compulsory license and get access to these channels anyway.
Right, because there is such a thing that the Copyright Office and the Copyright Act of 1976 offers called a compulsory license, so that if you're going to retransmit any broadcast signal, notice I did not say cable signal, then you just pay a compulsory license. And that's the way it was up until 1992. That is when the Cable Television and Consumer Protection
this
Act...
This is getting dense. Just say it simply.
Yeah. They
passed a law.
Right. That basically said, we're going to keep the compulsory license around, but we're also going to have this Communications Act retransmission consent, which allows broadcasters...
They passed a law because the broadcast network said, hey, cable companies are showing all our valuable programming, making all this money, and we're not getting a penny for it. You know, we were forcing people to show our stuff because we didn't want it to be, you know, cut out of the loop in local TV channels. Now we want to be paid for it. So they said, hey, pass the law and let us get paid for it. We want a piece of the pie too. And they said, fair enough. And they passed a new law to say, all right, cable companies, you got to pay the networks when you're showing their channels. Now, we used to say you're forced to do it. Now we're saying you're forced to pay for it.
Right.
Right? Right. So what happened? Aereo said, fine.
But the thing is, the law did not do away with the compulsory license. It's still there.
It's still there. And Aereo, all the way up to the Supreme Court, said, we're not a cable company. We're not a cable company. We're just renting antennas. And when the Supreme Court said they're a cable company, they said, fine, we're a cable company. And they went to the Copyright Office and they said, give us a compulsory license. And what did they say?
Well, the Copyright Office said that Aereo did not qualify for a compulsory license.
They said, you're not a cable company. We don't care what the Supreme Court said.
Yeah, we don't qualify because you're not a cable company.
So Aereo fought it all the way and said, we're not. Supreme Court said, yes, you are. So they said, fine, we are. And the Copyright Office said, no, you're not.
Yeah.
So where's this going to end up? Can they appeal the Copyright Office ruling?
I have no idea, but I just found it fascinating that you know, technology always outpaces legislation. And
especially old Supreme Court justices who don't even know the difference between a text and, you know, they don't know anything.
And an email.
They don't know a tweet and a text and an email. They don't know what DVRs are. They know nothing.
And this is where I think the whole thing completely breaks down. And if you actually just follow the law and said, look, the law says that what Aereo is doing technologically, yes, it's a loophole, and yes, they shouldn't be allowed to do it, but the law allows it.
So you change the law, it's allowed.
Yeah. Here, because they basically fell in between the law, they said you look like a cable company, not that you are a cable company. Now the Copyright Office gets to say, well, you're not a cable company. Just ask the Supreme Court. You just look like one.
In this case, the justices should have just told their clerks to write the ruling and leave them out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, if you want to know more about this, by the way, what you referred to, Michael, we had Denise Howell on episode 242 just a couple weeks ago discussing the whole Aereo case. So if you want to know more, go there. I just wanted to highlight the fact that the absurdity of the Supreme Court ruling and then what transpired after it.
Well, it's giving me a headache, and you know, nothing's changed, and I don't know if they can appeal it. So to me, it seems like a big whoop.
Oh, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Great, let's jump into politics. That'll keep people calm.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure nobody will actually have any opinions on this first story. Director Pedro Almodovar, Javier Bardem, and his wife Penelope Cruz, they all signed an open letter circulating throughout the Spanish media. It denounced Israel, blamed that country for the current violence going on in the Gaza Strip, demanded an end to the blockade of Gaza, and called for an end to their quote-unquote genocide of the Palestinian people.
No button pushing there.
Yeah, that's going to go over real well. Cruz later clarified her position by saying, I don't know those people. No, she later clarified her position by saying, she's no expert, she recognizes the situation is complex.
Bardem, thank you.
Bardem then clarified his position as well, saying that their denouncement of Israel was, in fact, a call for peace. And this is a quote, while I was critical of the Israeli military response, I have great respect for the people of Israel and deep compassion for their losses. Said another statement released by Bardem. That's what he just, Bardem said. No word yet from Mel Gibson or Gary Oldman, though right-wing actor John Voight, he weighed in and he said that all of them should hang their heads in shame. And Relativity CEO Ryan Kavanaugh says it makes his blood boil. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, other than Ryan Kavanaugh of Relativity deciding he never wants to work with Javier Bardem or Penelope Cruz.
That's okay, because I'm sure they did not want to work with him. So,
well, not after he said that.
Yes.
So, yeah, that seems an odd thing for a head of a production company to say in Hollywood, to attack the political views of actors. I mean, who are box office draws, you know, if you want to work with, what's their, why do you want to make it impossible for you to do business with them?
Yeah,
he doesn't own
agree.
That company. I'd be angry if I was a stockholder or an investor in Relativity. I'm saying, look, you just damaged my company by making it impossible for us to do work with certain actors for no good reason. Like, they have one opinion on Israel, you have another. That's nice. talk about, you're allowed to share your opinion, I guess, but don't spoil our business making possibilities.
Yeah, and it's one of those topics in Hollywood you just don't bring up. Just, religion.
No, I think we can solve it right now.
And,
let's solve it right now.
Yeah, because it only took 3,000 years for them to get to this part, and they're behaving so well, those parties over there in the Middle East, that they're really going to get along.
As Penelope Cruz says, it's complex.
Yes. what was complex? Negotiating, deals for the Big Bang Theory cast. That was complex.
That's true, but it's all over.
That's right. The cast of The Big Bang Theory ended their holdouts. They didn't pull a Friends and bargain together, though they probably should have, but the three leads did get the same basic deal. Johnny Galecki, Kelly Cuoco, and Jim Parsons will each get about $1 million per episode, plus a full point in the back end.
Each.
So, yeah.
And good three luck, points.
good luck collecting that. Co-stars Simon Helberg and Kunal Nayar. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I don't know.
Well, they will end their talk soon with a big bump, though, of course, not breaking anywhere near the seven figures that the primary cast members got. They are expected to find extra work on the weekends that is flexible enough to fit around the shooting schedule.
Making less money, that's what they got to do.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe ShopRite or, bagging groceries is really what I'm thinking. Starbucks, I believe, is also hiring. So big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. It was going to happen. Is there any shock? No. I don't know why the three leads didn't negotiate together. Apparently, Jim Parsons was like, hey, I've won all these Emmys. I'm the biggest name. I want a little bit more than the other. Like, why do you want bragging rights at this stage of the game? I just don't understand that ego. It's like, just work together and get it. You're all rich as sin.
What? I sometimes wonder if it's not the ego of the actor, but the ego of the representation.
Right. Well, then they're stupid to let their representation, wag the dog.
Well, sometimes it might not even be the direct representation, meaning
for the indirect representation.
And what I mean by that is, let's say Jim Parsons, and I'm just picking one of those actors. Let's say his agent works for one particular agency, Agency A. And the agent that is representing him at Agency A says, yeah, let's do this group negotiation thing. However, The heads of Agency A don't like the fact that the other two are represented by Agency B. And wants to.
Well, but they did it before, so I don't know why they didn't do it again.
Yeah, don't know.
I think at some point you got so much money, all you have left is ego.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you can't buy ego. Or maybe you've bought a bigger ego. I don't know. Maybe you've upgraded. You've renovated your ego. I don't know. Speaking of which, by the way, Michael, I saw a and this is a complete tributary or I don't know what you'd call
tributary?
This. Tributary? I keep calling them tributaries, but it's a non sequitur.
Okay.
But I saw a play called Buyer and Seller at the Mark Taper Forum this past week, which was very funny. Do you know what this play is about?
Of course. Who was in it?
Oh, geez. I knew you were going to ask me that. Michael Urie, I believe.
So he's the guy who originated the role.
Yes. And Michael Urie, you may know him from Ugly Betty. He played one of the receptionists on Ugly Betty.
Was he a receptionist?
Or an assistant. Oh, no. He was the assistant to, what's his name?
Vanessa Williams?
Yeah,
or the
what's
man,
her name?
Or
yeah.
The guy. Yeah. He was the gay assistant. He's an openly gay actor, and he plays a character in this show who's got a product that something that Barbara Streisand doll, or what is he selling? I forget.
Well, here's the thing. Barbara Streisand wrote this book, and I've seen this book, and you know, I can't say I've read it, but I've definitely read portions of it, called My Passion for Design. And it's all about how she kind of designed and renovated and built her big, you know, dream
and
palace
the character
out there
in this play.
Is actually in the book, she talks about building the basement of this mansion in Malibu and how it's basically set up like a mall, like an outdoor European mall. And so he plays the caretaker for all the shops in the mall. And, you know, it's all fictitious, of course.
Right. But it's a very clever play, great reviews. I don't know what in God's name this has to do with what we were talking about.
Ego.
That's why it's a non sequitur. But it does. It's a sort of a loving thing to Streisand, isn't it?
I think so. And quite honestly, if I were her, I'd say, "Hey, you know what? Let's turn this into a movie. I'm gonna play I'm gonna play Barbara Streisand it really paints her as a very smart woman. Actually,
yeah. So she doesn't show up in the play, obviously, but he talks to her on the phone.
No, he talks and actually acts as her and. He does a great job of delineating the different characters. Very
cool.
Good.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a terrific show. I was really sorry I missed it in New York.
Well, hopefully it'll come back.
And she deserves to have all the ego she wants. Moving on.
Okay. Well, we're moving on to... Oh, God, maybe I was just trying to avoid this next story. Because as the legal case put forward by the accuser of director Bryan Singer and other Hollywood figures collapses, so has the accuser's world. Michael Egan's attorney quit the case when Egan reportedly turned down $100,000 from Singer to just go away.
That's how we characterize it.
Yes. At the same time, Egan has now been tracked down and served with legal papers alleging a malicious lawsuit. That came from former TV exec Garth Ancier. It was served in the men's room of what Ancier called a, quote, an obscure Las Vegas casino, end quote. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I mean, it wasn't that he was at a Vegas casino. He was at an obscure Vegas casino. That's really just below the belt.
Yeah. I mean,
So Garth Ancier, I guess Ancier, is that how you say it?
Yes.
So I guess this was sort of a, what do you call it? Preemptive strike, because he's expecting or anticipating Egan might have filed a further lawsuit against him. I mean, because when he pulled some of his cases, they were pulled without prejudice or with prejudice, which meant that they could refile later. I forget which is
yes.
Which.
With prejudice means you can't. Without prejudice is, something like
so,
that.
So, of course, now his attorney has apparently left him. I guess he's without representation or maybe as someone else. This is as ugly as it gets. You'd like to think that they were all vindicated and that this guy has been exposed as a... You know, guy just after money, but who, you know, it's not over yet. I don't know what's going on. It's ugly, ugly, ugly. I would think he would want this to go away, Garth Ancier. So perhaps this is just a way of making sure he stays away.
Well, and quite honestly, I believe, you know, if you're going to use the court to go after somebody, and in this case, Michael Egan is going after these individuals, and you're going to make these accusations, not in a criminal court, but in a civil court, then there should be some, you know, I don't want to say tit for tat because that sounds kind of petty, but I mean, there should be some repercussions for that and some way of diverting that. And
repercussions, you mean if it wasn't true?
Yes.
There shouldn't be the problem is there shouldn't be repercussions if you're filing a lawsuit that has validity and they can bully you into submission because you can't afford to go against them. You know, that's the problem with a lot of legal cases. You can't go up against Walmart because you'll never make your money back.
Right.
Right. So
just see the movie A Civil Action and you'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, since the Hunger Games franchise is huge, it's no surprise their soundtrack is huge too. Though somehow the Twilight soundtracks remained even cooler than the films. I don't know how that is. Now, Hunger Games is playing catch up. The artist Lorde had a song on the last soundtrack. This time around, she's doing another single, and get this, she's curating the soundtrack as well, pairing the film completely with one of the coolest acts of the moment. Lorde, of course, is 17 years old, so of course that makes her the perfect music supervisor. So Katniss, by the way, would qualify as, Lorde's big sister? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously, but it's a smart move on their part. Lorde's star continues to rise remarkably fast. It's just, you know, Springsteen covering her song in Australia, this person, that, it's just, you know, it's crazy, performing at the Nirvana, it's just over the top, and she's 17.
Yes, I know.
No pressure on the second album.
Exactly. Now, I guess the New York Times, they're asking, how do you top Spider-Man? Turn off the dark. I almost forgot how to say it that way. That's the most expensive Broadway show in history.
Most expensive flop in history,
well,
probably.
Yep, it is. The answer, by the way, that the New York Times provides is produce a show based on the Chipmunks movie. That's right.
Movie as opposed to the property in general?
Apparently. They're adapting Chipwrecked. Because that was the best of the trio, I think.
Really?
I'm kidding. I have no idea.
Okay.
That's right. You heard us correctly. Michael Cole and Jeremiah J. Harris have plans to bring the animated rodent pop stars to Broadway. And as if that's not enough, the duo is also working with 20th Century Fox on a stage adaptation of... Wait for it. Wait for it, because you just know it's going to be good. Rio. That's right. The animated movie about a bird.
Well, that actually makes more sense to me. But anyway,
what?
Keep going.
The bird is animated. It talks.
Keep going.
Do you know any talking birds that can audition for that role?
A parrot.
Oh, good point. Actually, I take it all back. You're right. This news, by the way, also brought forth the news that Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. I can't believe I said that. Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark will not be opening in Las Vegas as originally announced, but instead as an arena tour is being put together. The last arena tour Mr. Cole planned on was Jesus Christ Superstar, but it had to be canceled due to poor ticket sales. I think we even talked
about that. It was a disaster. That was with Johnny Rotten. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now his production of A Night with Janis Joplin was also closed due to this thing called poor ticket sales. So big deal or big whoop.
Big whoop. Obviously, all this stuff is so vague. I mean, the Spider-Man tour is nothing's happened. It's just, we're not going to do that. You know, it's always meant to be that way. And that was what they always intended. But nothing is planned. Nothing is set. There are no cities locked in. There's no production locked in. There's no money funding it. So that's just all talk. Rio, they're actually planning to do in Rio de Janeiro. That's where they're going to launch the project. That actually makes sense. It's a musical. I mean, there's music in the Chipmunks movie. They started as musical novelty act, obviously, as a record. And I guess there's music there. But Rio really is a musical. And I can totally see that as a flashy stage musical. That to me makes a little bit more sense. Chipmunks seems like a bad idea. You know, birds somehow seem easier than chipmunks to do on Broadway. I don't know why.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into...
Was there a single big deal? I think they were all big whoops.
They were all big whoops.
That's the week we've had.
Yes. Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess, I don't know how this affects our listeners, at least not directly. This is an indirect affection, if you will. It will indirectly affect our listeners.
That's all I've ever gotten is indirect affection.
Oh, my. I knew. I said, I said that statement, and I knew you were going to go there. It's not quite the Alamo, but film stock is definitely on its last legs. We've talked about this before. The format of physical 35mm film is so out of demand that Kodak was poised to end production of the format forever. But a few diehard filmmakers still want the beauty of actual celluloid for some or all of their projects down the road. So J.J. Abrams, Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, and a few other hacks pushed studios to make a deal and keep Kodak in the business of film. Kodak is literally the last company standing when it comes to celluloid, and their tentative agreement with the studios also includes discussions about other elements of support needed, like the labs, let's say. Like Photochem needs to kind of stick around.
Yeah, they're the last lab in Hollywood, aren't they?
Yes.
The last film lab. There's nobody else.
Deluxe closed their film plant in Hollywood and literally auctioned off the equipment.
Right.
You could have bought a piece of Deluxe. You couldn't have owned the company, you know, piece of the company, but you could have literally bought a physical piece of the Deluxe Film Lab.
That's right. And Martin Scorsese, of course, weighed in. He just did that today. He's got a lot of film preservation work he does. And he released a statement saying how happy he was and why it's important, especially for film preservation. And he said in a statement, quote, HD isn't coming. It's here. Even those of us still shooting on film finish in HD and our projects are projected in HD. So we could easily agree that the future is here, that film, meaning celluloid, is cumbersome and imperfect and difficult to transport and prone to wear and tear. And it's time to forget the past and say goodbye. Really, that could be easily done. Too easily. Everything we do in HD is an effort to recreate the look of film. Film, even now, offers a richer visual palette than HD. And we have to remember that film is still the best and only time-proven way to preserve movies. We have no assurance that digital information will last, but we know that film will if properly stored and cared for, end quote.
Yes, it's very well put together. And he did in one paragraph what it's taken me, about 9 trillion words to do for Celluloid Junkie, where I am writing a story on this very topic. And really, my take on it is Kodak has a chance to make themselves cool and hip again by becoming the choice of A-list directors, by becoming the...
Well, this is boutique business, obviously. It's right. Just being done because they're keeping a lifeline open. So it's not going to refurbish their brand and make them hot again. But I've seen a lot of stuff online about archivists, people working in museums and libraries, people working in documentary film, and they all say, hey, you've made this film on HD. You've shot it with your camera. You shot it with your iPhone. You got it in Sundance. That's great. You know what you need to do? Make a celluloid print.
Yes.
You need to make a print of that digital film. It never existed on celluloid, but you need to make a copy on celluloid. Spend the money because that's the best way to archive it. Because you know what? The format you used to archive your digital print last year is outdated. And next year will be outdated again.
It's kind of like saying, hey, you wrote your screenplay in Final Draft or Microsoft Word. You know what you really need to do? Print it out on paper and store it, you know, on a shelf somewhere. Because
print is not so difficult. No, but
it's equivalent to, look, you know what? Paper and analog format, celluloid and analog format. Yeah. You need to have something physical that you can touch.
Depending on the paper that you print it on.
Well, okay, good point.
And how you store it. You know, like if you crappy print paper that can dissolve in a month, you know, but acid-free paper, yeah, that would archive and be stored a long time under proper conditions. And you don't have to worry about, is your old computer, can people open it and access it and get your... I've got stuff on an old laptop I'd love to access. I can't get in there.
You know what? Ask the National Security Agency. I hear they have everything.
That's right. So why is this important?
Well, it's
important. It's good for preservation, obviously, because like 99% of all movies ever made were made on celluloid.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's important because of who is joining the fight here. But really, this is filmmakers kind of forcing the issue. If it wasn't for the filmmakers and the creative preference that they have and their ability to force that onto a studio, then Kodak would be out of business. This is important because of what happened to Kodak and how they basically went from an innovative company at the turn of the century, the 1900s, to one that just kind of rested on its laurels.
And to be clear, film is not coming back. It's not being saved. It's not going to have a resurgence. Someone will always want a film on celluloid, just like someone will always want to make a movie in black and white, just like Jack White sometimes records songs on 78s.
Right.
But that doesn't mean 78s are suddenly going to be sweeping the nation. So celluloid is not, you know, there are no theaters showing celluloid anymore unless you go to Argentina.
good point. Ooh, nice way to bring back our previous news story. I like that.
It's almost
like you were paying attention through the whole show.
So essentially, film is dead.
Oh, I see what you want to do. You want to move us on to our obituaries for the week. Some of the people who unfortunately won't be joining us for next week's episode.
That's right. And ways to try to remember and celebrate what they do. That's what we've got at the end of the show. We're trying this out now. This makes me feel old. Michael Johns. You don't even know who he is. He's an American Idol top 10 finalist. He competed in 2008. He died of a blood clot in his ankle at 35. You know, it's like people from American Idol are dying now, not even the judges, but contestants. That's very depressing. But obviously, he died very young and he was doing all right. You know, he had two record deals before he went on Idol. You know, he was on one record deal and then the label collapsed on another record deal and they fired all the people. And so all the young bands were dismissed. So he had a couple chances. He finally got on Idol. That didn't quite work for him. He made it to number 8. but David Foster, the producer, liked him. So he's had a career. He's been writing songs. He's been appearing on PBS specials and stuff. So he was still chugging along and making it happen. But, you know, he died at 35.
Robert Halmy Sr., however, was actually quite old. I think he was 94. He's the Hungarian-born producer of, I guess, some flashy TV movies and miniseries like...
Hugely successful.
Yeah, Gypsy, Moby Dick, Arabian Nights. And I guess his crowning achievement would be the Emmy-winning series Gulliver's Travels.
I know people who love this. They say it's the definitive Gulliver's Travels. It stars Ted Danson of Cheers, and it was just a monster hit on television when it aired.
Yeah, and I think he was 90, actually. And also in his 90s was Dick Smith, who was a makeup artist. He did The Godfather, so I guess you have him to blame for, that cheek implant, Marlon Brando.
Wasn't it just cotton?
Yeah, I know. I'm kidding. Yes.
But he did do his makeup. Yeah.
Yes. The Godfather, Amadeus, The Exorcist, Little Big Man, Taxi Driver, The Hunger. He did a lot, actually. He mentored Rick Baker, among others. And he created like this new way of layering on masks, that kind of, you know, that rubberized layering. He kind of helped revolutionize that art form.
Yeah, because in the old day, you'd make a mask and just put one mask on everybody, so it didn't fit well. And he created one that was specially designed for each face, and he was hugely influential. That's the way everyone did it after he created it, and he mentored a lot of people. In fact, we found out about his death from a tweet from Rick Baker, who was mentored by Dick Smith, and you know, he made his career and a lot of other people. And so he, you know, when he died, Rick let the world know. So I thought that was a nice way for him to say goodbye. He had passed the torch on to people like Rick Baker. And so that was cool to see. And then another person died.
And this person you're probably not going to know.
Alan J. Schwalb, S-C-H-W-A-L-B. He's a money man. He's a financier in Hollywood. This guy had a life. This guy was a kid. He sang backup for major doo-wop and pop artists like Jay and the Americans. He got 5 master's degrees. That led him to the aerospace industry. And on the side, he started to invest in the stock market. And he did so well, the other scientists said, hey, why don't you take my money and invest it as well? So then he went on and he invested in the musical Annie on its way to Broadway. He invested in Casablanca Records in the 70s, which was the home of disco and Kiss and Donna Summer. And then he went into film and he invested via Caracol and Orion during their salad days. I mean, in the 80s and 70s, Orion was just the hottest studio in all of Hollywood. They were winning Oscars. They were making great big hit movies. They were just the golden child. And he even invested in the Orlando Magic towards the end of his days, you know, the sports franchise. So this guy did everything. And you know what? No listing in Wikipedia.
Wow.
Because nobody cares about the money man. You know, people say movies begin with the written word. That's what the WGA would have you believe. It begins with the written word, with a man sitting at his typewriter or his laptop typing the words of it. Nope. It
begins. I'd like to go back. It definitely not a typewriter.
It begins with money. Because you can write all the scripts you want. If nobody steps up with the money, that movie's never getting made. You know, setting aside making a movie with your iPhone, talking about a Hollywood movie, you got to have people with money. So people like Alan J. Schwalb, who, my God, he had success in theater, in music, in sports, and in stock markets, and singing as a talent himself, and then in film. You know, this guy did everything and kind of a cool guy. I'm sure everybody in Hollywood knew him, or a lot of people. I never heard of him before.
And now you've heard about him here on Showbiz Sandbox.
That's right. And let's hope, however, that his last project, one that he was working on, can slip quietly away, just like Alan did. It was a sequel to It's a Wonderful Life. Why anyone would want to make a sequel to It's a Wonderful Life, other than the fact that you own the rights, is beyond me.
Well, there will be a sequel to this episode of Showbiz Sandbox. I don't know whether it'll be next week, because I'm traveling and, Michael, you're traveling. So I don't know why.
I'm not traveling next week. It's all on you, baby. Don't blame it on me.
Okay, well, we'll have to...
It's your fault. So you don't even know?
I don't even know.
All right.
I don't know.
You should have set it up at the show. There may or may not be a show. Look for our tweets or look for our comments on Facebook. If you follow us there, you can find out whether there will be a show.
That's right. And in the meantime...
And if there isn't, blame it on Sperling.
Yes. Or instead, you could do something more positive, like subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. That's where we can be found. Please do rate and review the show in those aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, or ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us, 888-567-7263. You can even follow us on Twitter, where our handle is Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-changing list of websites that he mentions at the end of each show. Michael, this week, what website should we be sending people to?
I loved Chris Pratt before Chris Pratt was cool.com.
There's a lot of C's in that one. So,
I loved him since Etherwood, but someone's been working out.
That is true. If the C button key on your laptop mate is broken or your computer's broken, hey, you know what? Just try michaelgiltz.com. Although actually you wouldn't be able to type Michael. But in any case, michaelgiltz.com is where you can find some of Michael's writing. Celluloidjunkie.com is where you can find some of my writing. Until next week, play nice.